I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this beautiful Friday afternoon. We've been talking about New Jersey and the looming yet strangely delicate black ironwork span of the Pulaski Skyway is familiar to anyone who's driven up the New Jersey Turnpike or anyone who's watched the opening scenes of The Sopranos. The elevated roadway through the Meadowlands was built in the early part of the 20th century and is the subject of a new book called The Last 3 Miles, Politics, Murder, and the Construction of America's First Superhighway, published by the New Press. I'm pleased that it brings author Stephen Hart to the show today. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
So what made for the Pulaski Skyway looks like no other roadway that I've ever seen. Why does it have that strange and beautiful shape where it's got those concrete supports, and then, as you write, it looks like it's dancing on top of it?
It is a remarkable structure. Depending on the mood I'm in, I either think it's an abomination or a thing of true beauty. It's a truss bridge, which is hard to warm up to at first. Everybody loves suspension bridges, the George Washington and so on.
Because they've got those long towers and those graceful expanses.
If you look at some of the books on engineering design, American structural art, for example, they'll talk about how truss bridges, they look better from a distance than up close. And that's certainly the case with the Skyway. Up close, you know, all you see is rotting concrete and rusty steel.
Which can be beautiful in its own way, but is a little scary, too, sometimes when you're driving under it on the New Jersey Turnpike.
When I was doing the research for the book, I was interested in seeing the Skyway's place in American culture. So a few years after it opened, it got its first mention in the War of the Worlds broadcast that Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater did. A few years after that, it turned up in the opening shot in the Hitchcock film Shadow of a Doubt.
So, and as you've mentioned, ominous is something that's associated with it.
And then with the Sopranos reference, we have crime and terror, which are both kind of appropriate given the Skyway's history.
Well, that I found your book very interesting, partly because of my own roots, which is in Jersey City. That's where my grandparents lived and where my mom grew up. And Frank Haig, even when I was growing up, was a name to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, he one of the least appreciated and least understood figures of 20th century American politics. His official title was mayor of Jersey City, which he held from 1917 to 1947. And for 2 years thereafter, he tried to pull the strings from a distance through his nephew.
Because 30 years was just not enough.
Well, he is one of the, if not the, longest-lived political bosses of urban political machines. What he accomplished was to weld the Democratic votes of Hudson County and control them so completely that if you were a Democratic candidate, you needed Frank Haig on your side. If you were a presidential candidate, he could give you a big plurality in the Democratic primary. He chose several governors. George Silzer, Edward I. Edwards, A. Harry Moore, they were all Haig men. Charles Edison, the son of the inventor, who was governor for a term, he couldn't have gotten it without Frank Haig's support. He, at the time, New Jersey was mostly a rural, underpopulated state, and cities held quite a lot of influence, particularly Hudson County.
Newark and Jersey City. Hudson,
that's right.
Newark and Essex County, and then Jersey
that's
City
right.
and Hudson County. When the Holland Tunnel was constructed, you start the book there, because that was really the first way that people could get to and from New York.
That's right.
But what happened when the Holland Tunnel emptied into Jersey City before the Skyway was built?
Well, it opened in 1927. Everybody knew early on that something was going to have to be done to accommodate the literally millions of cars that were coming out and eddying in the streets of Jersey City. On the other side of Jersey City from the Holland Tunnel is the Meadowlands, the big swamp, and that had historically been a barrier to travel. Even at the time the Holland Tunnel opened, there were only some small local roads with drawbridges. Frequent ship traffic causing them to open. They were so low to the water that just about anything bigger than a Dixie cup, you had to open the drawbridge. And traffic would back up. People saw this coming, and they began preparations for what would become known as the first superhighway project in America, an extension of Route 1 from Elizabeth down in Union County up to the mouth of the Holland Tunnel. There were some political scandals and delays in getting this done. So when the Holland Tunnel opened, most of the extension was still being built. The reason I call this book The Last 3 Miles is that the Skyway was literally the last three-mile stretch of the Route 1 extension, and it took from 1930 to 1932 to complete it.
It must have been a mess from 1927 to 1932 when you came out of the Holland Tunnel.
It was. George Silzer warned the legislature that if we don't get this project rolling, all the benefits of the Holland Tunnel are going to be negated.
Not that it isn't often a mess now, right. Getting out even with the Skyway and the Turnpike extension and all of those.
Well, you can imagine in the period, I spoke to a woman who, in her 90s, who had lived in that period, and she described the streets were still, you still had a lot of horse-drawn buggies, trucks, and they would all, this rabble of traffic would try and be getting across the meadowlands, and it would take hours.
I'm glad you told me that, because that was what my kids were interested in, is when this tunnel went in, were there still horses on the street?
Oh, sure.
And it was hard for them to imagine what that would be like driving a car, I mean, granted a 1927's car, through the streets of Jersey City.
Well, you can tell them that garbage hauling in Jersey City was still done by horse-drawn carts well into the 40s, because, you know, trucks don't have family members who will vote for you. And one of the secrets of running a patronage machine is that you have to have lots of people with their destinies bound up in your operation. So it was a long time before the truck hauled garbage.
One of our earlier guests, James Kaplan, was talking about Longy's Woolman and how he handed out bread and he handed out matzah. This seemed to be a way to garner more support in Jersey City also. It sounds like the political machine also knew how to make friends.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things to remember about political machines is they came about because they were necessary. You had waves of immigrants coming into the city. The white Protestant, mostly Republican establishment didn't want anything to do with them. So the machines tapped into, well, it was a combination of charity and hardcore political opportunism. A new family moves into your neighborhood, and if you were a ward leader for Frank Haig, you did not have a restful life. If a new family came into the neighborhood, you were supposed to be there. If they needed help getting phone service, getting things arranged, you were there to help. If a member of the family got into trouble with the law, maybe you could help smooth things out. You were there to present a human face for the political organization in every possible way.
It seemed, though, that it was still broken down on ethnic lines. In reading your book, I am a product of Jewish Jersey City, and there's only one scene in the book with someone who's Jewish, and he's getting beat up pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
So there were, it did sound like things were still fractured in that way.
Well, I mean, Haig's organization, he was Irish-American, Irish Catholic, and, you know, that was the source of his voting power. I mean, there were entry points for other ethnic groups. It was definitely an Irish Catholic, Irish American machine, but other ethnic groups would get a slice of the pie in exchange for their support. The incident you refer to was from the 1940s when you had the 1930s when he was really going all out against labor unions and making speeches about communist influence and keep the Reds out of Jersey City. Very paranoid, Cold War kind of atmosphere.
I'm speaking with Stephen Hart. He's written a book called The Last 3 Miles, Politics, Murder, and the Construction of America's First Superhighway. Now, Stephen, you talk about labor. There were some very ugly labor wars going on during the 2 years that the Pulaski Skyway was being constructed.
That's right. It all centered around a man named Teddy Brandl, who was a former iron worker himself, who had managed to weld together most of the construction trade locals in northern New Jersey under his leadership. He was a former ally of Frank Haig. They had worked together throughout most of the 1920s. For a while, Jersey City was very rare in that the Jersey City police would turn back strike breakers. That was definitely not the norm in the rest of the country. And Haig and Teddy Brandl were so closely allied that Teddy Brandl actually started his own bank, the Labor National Bank, the building of the headquarters of which is still in Journal Square. It's a historic site. He ensured that labor votes would be in Frank Haig's column. And they had their falling out just before the Pulaski Skyway project was about to come through Hudson County. And it became the scene of a labor war involving Teddy Brandl's men who were picketing the construction sites.
And there were murders and there was intimidation. It sounded pretty ugly.
It was very ugly. It was a pitched battle across the length of the Meadowlands.
Which is not a pleasant place to have a battle. I mean, I think about it. You write about it in the summertime. It would not be a lovely place to be working or picketing.
No, very grueling to be working there and to be picketing there. It all culminated in the murder of a non-union bridge worker in 1932, in the winter of 1932, which led to a pretty sensational murder trial. I mean, before that, there had been numerous scuffles, and a man had been shot in the back and partially paralyzed. The bridge companies that were there were ferociously anti-union, and they hired a detective agency, which, according as was done frequently at the time, what they called detectives were more like hired muscle. And it was a running battle. Bridge companies would use all kinds of strategies to get their workmen to the site. Sometimes they would bring them up in tugboats. Sometimes they would put them on barges and have them sleep overnight on the river. Constant chess game going on between Brandl and the bridge companies. And Frank Haig, I think, saw that Brandl was overmatched in this fight. And he was waiting to let Brandl wear himself out against these four very implacable opponents.
So, you know, it took a long time to build. It was in the midst of the Depression. This structure still exists today, and people still go careening down this skyway. Was it a success, and does it still have a lasting legacy?
Well, at the time that it opened on Thanksgiving Day in 1932, it was hailed as the Highway of the Future, which at the time it was being built. See, one of the things when I began research for this book, I thought, I'm going to find out what crazy people designed this thing, because its design flies in the face of everything. Access and egress in the center, left lane, the fast lane.
It's not much fun to drive on.
But it was all for very logical reasons. The design was based on engineering principles from railroad design.
Well, you can find out more about I keep calling it the Skolaski Highway, but it's the Pulaski Skyway in Stephen Hart's new book. It's called 3 Miles, The Last 3 Miles, Politics, Murder, and the Construction of America's First Superhighway. It's from the New Press. And later on this summer, in August, Stephen Hart will have a book event you can find out at our show page, wnyc.org.